He was slinging puns at a B&B when he had an epiphany. And they complained about Tom too, about not playing D&D. It was free throw, and I heard him say, keep off my borderlands. But just sit back and let Spencer do his trick, cause you're incapable AMs.
Hello, and welcome to Keep Off the Borderlands, I think. A podcast about RPGs and stuff. My name is Spencer, aka Free Thrall, and the reason I'm unsure about what kind of episode this is, I originally intended to put out a bunch of shorter Between the Borderlands episodes, and I was also intending to do a proper Keep Off the Borderlands episode about the struggles I've had playing solo. But this month has kind of got away from me. Life is life. And, well, you know how it is. I've got a bunch of calls that are in dire need of a response, some questions to answer, and some feedback regarding Dragon Slayer, last month's movie night. And also, I need to remind you of this month's movie, John Borman's Excalibur from 1981. I will need your entries by the 22nd, is it? God, well, I've left this reminder a little bit late, haven't I? The episode will be airing on the 25th. I still need to find some time to watch the movie myself, but I assure you, it will happen. So, yeah, I'd really appreciate hearing your feedback. And if you'd like it to be part of the episode, then please make sure it's with me on the 22nd. You can send that feedback via email, spencer.freethrall@gmail.com, via speakpipe.com/keepoffthebalderlands, all one word. But possibly the simplest way is to send me the audio via Discord. Details on how to find me there are in the show notes. I very much look forward to hearing from you. So yeah, let's get to those messages, shall we?
Hey Spencer, Jason here. Just listening to your latest episode. Heard Minions Call and your response to Minions Call. And, you know, I'm not sure what this says for us as a whole, but I think on average, more people are going to remember King Osric as the character that Max Vincenau, man, I butchered his name, played in Conan the Barbarian as opposed to the historical King Osric. Let me get back to your show.
Thank you, Jason. Always good to ease myself into these messages with a call from Jason Connolly of Nerds RPG Variety Cast. And, well, I say easing myself in. I'm struggling to remember which episode Jason is referring to here, but he's clearly referring to a call from Menyon, a.k.a. Rob, of the Confessions of a Wee Timorous Bushi podcast. Osric, the old school reference and index compilation from Stuart Marshall and Matt Finch. Minion mentioned that system. In my response to his message, I referenced King Osric, the 6th century Anglo-Saxon king, completely forgetting the king of the same name from Conan the Barbarian, played by Max von Sydow. That movie being the movie of the month for December of last year, Jason's last episode of Movie Monday before handing over the reins to myself. Now, between you and me, I don't know enough about the Conan stories to know whether King Osric appears in the literature, but thank you, Jason, for reminding us of the late, great Max von Sydow, who we sadly lost back in 2020. Thanks for your call, Jason. And, well, guess who's up next?
Hello, Spencer. This is Rob, also known as Many Hunk, calling from Confessions of a Wee Timorous Bushy. And I'm calling in response to your show, which was called something, and I can't check it at the moment. So, but it was the one where you're talking about you're getting back to people on... it's not the dice. You did two episodes. So I've been listening to a couple of your episodes. So the dice one was very interesting. Really enjoy your bringing back also the ideas that Safer shared and sort of reworking that with some other people's ideas and sort of thinking over what a role-playing game is for you and what you want to get out of that experience. I think it's really helpful to return to these things. But the real reason I'm calling in at the moment is in response to Goblin's Henchman's call-in regarding the Dungeon Master, which I've not seen, but he mentions Caleb Dark, the comic strip, and he says that there was some kind of problem surrounding that and that it was discontinued. Now, Caleb Dark, for those who don't know, was, as far as I can tell, it was a two-part, maybe only two parts, or maybe perhaps three parts, comic series, a very short comic that was tucked into the back of Games Workshop's Citadel Chronicle, I think it was number 3, and some maybe one or two Citadel journals thereafter. And yeah, it was a very interesting comic. It was apparently, you know, stylistically, I wouldn't be surprised if it was done by the people that did, one of the artists, Judge Dredd. I don't have it at hand and I'm not going to check. But I think, and here's my take on it, and I'm not sure of this, so perhaps Goblin's Henchman is right, but I thought it was discontinued because of possible copyright infringement of Michael Moorcock. Because not only do you have the forces of law and chaos, which is problematic enough, and you have the god Khorne, who Caleb is largely fighting against, Khorne, of course, having chaos warriors that scream out, Blood for the Blood God, which is very similar to Elric's battle cry of Blood and Souls for my Lord Arioch. Now, the figure, the god, Malal, if that's his name, something like that, is very, very similar to Arioch in some ways in that he is very happy to fight against other Chaos Lords as well as Lords of Law. And like Elric, the main character, Caleb, who wields a certain magical item that I'll talk about in a moment, also has a deep grudge against Chaos. And so he makes a pact with the Chaos Lords to fight back. That's not exactly like Elric, but it's similar enough, I think. There's a similarity that Elric is also kicking back against his own society. He is obviously an emperor, but he hates the empire that he's inherited and the debauchery, the corruption of the Melnibonian people, which he believes have kind of fallen into. They've descended into a worse than a barbaric state because they've just become so debauched, right? Now, here's the thing. Caleb wields a kind of war axe, but it looks like a pterodactyl's head. It's a demon weapon, this war axe. And when it comes down on people, it claims their soul. It drinks the blood and soul out of the individuals that he defeats with it. And that is as close as you're going to get to Stormbringer as anything else, right? So I wonder if it was discontinued because it was just getting way too close and showing the world of Warhammer, the developing world of Warhammer, as being incredibly close to that of the Young Kingdoms, Michael Moorcock's Elric setting. What do you think? Anybody have more information on that? Right, cheers.
Thank you, Menyon, a.k.a. Rob of Confessions of a Wee Timorous Bushy. Don't worry, Rob, I can't remember what the title of that episode is either. Now, this is an interesting one because it was a litigation dispute that caused the Chaos God Malal and his champion Caleb Dark to be removed from the Warhammer canon, but it was nothing to do with Michael Moorcock. It was in fact that they were creations of John Wagner and Alan Grant, indeed, both worked on Judge Dredd and other strips from 2000 AD. Yet those characters were not actually owned by Games Workshop. And when they started appearing in Warhammer material and as miniatures, that created a problem. They did not actually have the rights to do that. And that is why these particular characters disappeared. So, yeah, there you go. That was an interesting rabbit hole to have been sent down. Thank you very much for that, Rob. Cheers for your call. Just butting in here because I learned earlier today that Rob is stepping away from podcasting for a while and gaming, by the sounds of it. Rob, if you're listening, I hope whatever it is you're dealing with works out as best as can be. Your dulcet wisdom will certainly be missed.
Hey, Spencer. Carl calling. So, listening to your Dragon Slayer movie night recap, I'll get to that in a bit, but the first message is going to be, because of movie night, man, I probably did something a little foolish because I love it when I sign up for games and I'm probably not quite prepared. But because of movie night, I was inspired to run a Dark Ages Call of Cthulhu adventure. And it's called, I think, Tonight We Hunt Dragons, something like that. And running it for a weekend with good friends, and the Friends of Jackson Elias, they put on a biannually, I think, sort of a online meet and greet, play your games, run your games convention. That's what it's called. And I decided to run two games, a Delta Green adventure, Full Moon Over Miami, which is a continuation of my Delta Green series saga that one of these days will be published, I hope. And this is like the third part of it. Played two parts already, back-to-back years at a weekend with good friends. And then I decided to run the Call of Cthulhu. Like I said, Tonight We Hunt Dragons, inspired by this movie night. Is it going to be a dragon? Interesting. It is Call of Cthulhu, but I set it in sort of circa 900 under Danelaw occupation of Eastern Mercia.
Thank you, Carl. Carl Rodriguez there of the GMologist Presents podcast and YouTube channel. That's really cool that Dragon Slayer has inspired a Call of Cthulhu game. You're planning to, run. You must have already run by now. Be interested to hear how that went. If you haven't already spoken about it, apologies. I'm a little behind on my podcast listening at the moment. Just butting in here to say that I have listened to that episode, Carl, where you recapped on the weekend. Sounds like you had an amazing time. And that scenario that you ran based on the hunt, with you having, sounds like you had Celtic characters, Saxons and Danes all thrown in there. That mix of pagan and Christian ideas and, sounds like you had a really good time with that. And a weekend with good friends seems like such a cool event run by the good friends of Jackson Elias. It's something that I hope to involve myself in at some point in the future. I play Call of Cthulhu more than anything else, and yet it's a game I don't really talk about. That's partially because it's an actual play and I don't want to give away any spoilers. But I'm aware that I don't really talk about Call of Cthulhu as a system. And whenever I do reference it, it's often in the context of the system doesn't really matter to me. But essentially, it's just that the system is doing its job and staying out of the way. Now, I got the impression that there was going to be a follow-up message to that, but I never received anything, Carl. Whether there was a subsequent thought or a subsequent message that didn't make it through to me, it will remain a mystery. Anyway, thank you very much for your call, Carl. However, I do have a couple more messages regarding the Movie Monday Dragon Slayer episode.
Hey, Spencer, it's Anthony calling in from not the road. I'm calling in from a parking lot. I want to apologize for not being able to get enough time together to record something for the Dragon Slayer movie night episode. I really wanted to, but having listened to all of the calls, nothing that I would have raised was missed. I was getting a little worried that no one was going to tie our main character to Ally McBeal, but fortunately Goblin's henchmen and the Umber Bulk made sure that that salient point came out. But this call is really in response to some of the, I don't know, questions that were raised or points of discussion which were raised, particularly about, let's say, the overarching theme of Dragon Slayer. And this is a movie we've talked about a lot over the years in different contexts. But it strikes me that the film is talking about or showing a time of transition, a time of great change. Now, our wizardly character, he recognizes the change is coming, and he recognizes what this change is asking of him. And this gives him a very pivotal position in the film, in that he can simply choose to walk away from this, and his life will continue, and things will remain the same. Or he can, take on a role of self-sacrifice, because that is ultimately what it is, and maybe, possibly from his point of view, a redemptive act. And so we have this theme of the old ways and the new ways. We have the villagers who are seeking change. They want freedom from the tyranny of the old ways, of the dragon, let's say. And we have the king who wants to preserve the status quo. Everything's going just fine, right? We can wait the dragon out, as it were, because little does he know, there are more dragons. It might not be a male dragon at that. So, in the palace, we see this theme of change between father and daughter. The daughter taking on the notion of a responsibility to one's subjects, whereas the father holds the notion of one's subjects having a responsibility to you. We have our ostensible villain seeking to prevent any change from happening, and we have our ostensible hero being entrusted, largely as an act of faith, to carry out all of the complicated and vague steps necessary to allow for the wizard's redemptive act in striking down the dragon. I think there's a lot going on in this film, and we can enjoy it for its amazing and groundbreaking special effects, which, of course, led to subsequent breakthroughs, which give us, some of the amazing CGI that we have today when people care to make it amazing. And, it launched some careers, although, Peter McNichol shied away from being public about having been in this film. I'm not sure I agree that he was bad in it, but I do agree he wasn't very compelling in it. But I think it's hard to walk away from the film without having thoughts. The tremendous pacing and the way that tension builds across the film helps keep the attention of younger viewers so they can be exposed to some of these ideas, and it counterpoints the revelations that are coming as we go through as older viewers. I first saw this in the theater while I was traveling around my home province in Canada, Nova Scotia. I was traveling around the Highlands, the Cape Breton Highlands, and I got to see it in a movie theater there. And so the environment in which I saw the film, in a way, in a very dim and distant way, mirrored the environment of the film, and it kept it in my mind for quite a while as a kid, having seen it. But you know, I think there's a lot here, and I think on the surface we can say, well, it seems kind of an odd mix that, you know, there's these, let's say, pagan ways, or these you know, polytheistic ways, as Menyon, I think, better puts it, coming into conflict with Christian ways. And this is kind of one additional layer added to the film, which might not be necessary. And then we have the intrigues in the palace, and that's another layer which might not be interesting and or might not be necessary. And if we cut them out, maybe we could have a, you know, a faster film with a shorter runtime, and it might have been more popular or more easy to understand, and this sort of thing. And I think all that stuff is true, but it would not have been the film that the authors wanted to present. And I think there's still more that was cut out of the film to make it as short as it is. But you know, it strikes me as really interesting that we have people relying on the system to keep them all safe, you know, the lottery and the dragon. And then this new faith is coming in, and people are going to rely on it in the same way. So they're simply going to pray, as Joe points out, and that, you know, they're expecting God to do all the work. They're expecting the lottery to do all the work. They're not being active in and of themselves. And I think this is one of the major messages of the film, in that the wizard recognizes that in order for change to be made, that there need to be sacrifices, and there needs to be a personal connection to the change that you will, you know, be the change you want to see in the world, you know. And he carries it out with an act of faith. He does not communicate clearly. He does not spell things out. He entrusts his fate to his apprentice and to his manservant. And maybe things will work out, and maybe they don't. And of course, we have another subtle dig when it is the king who has demonstrated to be the dragon slayer, as he drives the sword into the obvious carcass of the beast, and now the official history of who slayed the dragon is known. I think this is a not so subtle yet often overlooked message, similar to the very blatant but, you know, again, rarely talked about flare of the cross as the gem is destroyed and the eclipse happens. We have a literal cross flaring in the sky. And we rarely hear talk about how the dragon itself bears a sort of cruciform look, and how our wizard meets his end, in a sense, crucified. So we kind of have a redemptive act, a self-sacrificing, suicidal act to wipe away the sins of the past to make room for a new future. So I think the film has a lot to say about changing the world, and how difficult that can be. Anyway, sorry to have missed the official call-in show, and I hope this wasn't too long, but of course, we know it was.
Thank you, Anthony. Anthony Runeslinger Boyd there of the Casting Shadows podcast. Some really interesting points there, despite the fact that you felt everything was covered in the episode. It is indeed a film about transition. The people clearly want change. Those in power want to maintain the status quo. And yeah, in many ways, some things just don't change, do they? The time of magic, the sorcerer, and the dragon, in a way, to me, represent those who are willing to accept their fate in being the catalysts for change. The princess, Valerian, and Galen, regardless of how reluctant he is, they all recognize
the sacrifices they have to make. I don't know why, but I'd completely forgotten about the scene with the king driving his sword into the dragon carcass, possibly because, well, that isn't the story I want to be told. We know what really happens, but the world, the establishment, want and perhaps even need their own version of events. Thank you very much for your call, Anthony. Thinking back to Joe Richter of Hindsightless, his message in the Dragonslayer episode, his thoughts around the lottery brought to mind that idea of the needs of the many outweighing the needs of the few. Sacrifice yourself to save others, sure, that's the noble thing to do, but killing innocents in order to maintain the comfortable existence you're accustomed to, well, there's nothing noble about that. At the risk of getting political, well, it's not really political, is it? It's a moral concern. There's certainly plenty of people in power willing to exploit such situations, and far too many of us willing to turn a blind eye to that. On that note, I think we need to hear a bit more from Joe to lighten things up.
Yo, Spencer, just got listening to your Dragon Slayer episode, and it was awesome. Everybody had such rad stuff to say, except for Lex. No, just kidding, Lex. I love what you had to say, man, and I just love your energy, too. But yeah, it seemed like everybody really enjoyed the movie, and as you know, I made clear, I totally love the movie. Jason talks about how he likes it better than Lady Hawk, and the Umber Bulk talked about how he likes Lady Hawk better than Dragon Slayer. Oof, that's tough for me. I really love both of these movies. Rutger Hauer is just the coolest dude ever in Lady Hawk. Dragon Slayer is just awesome, though. If I could only take one of them with me, maybe Dragon Slayer. Maybe. Anyway, speaking of Jason, he mentioned that the king was just doing what he thought was best for the kingdom. But was he? Was he really? He was doing, in my opinion, what he felt was best for his family. That's why he was keeping his daughter out of the lottery. And also, as Minion pointed out, why does it have to be young virgin girls? Why can't it be young virgin boys? Why can't it be old men or old women or a cow? Like, we have no indication that any of the humans did any sort of testing to be like, well, maybe it doesn't have to be these young women just coming into their livelihoods. Maybe it could just be sheep. We don't know. All we do know is that the kings said it has to be virgin girls, and we don't know why they said that. And so because of that, and because the king is keeping his daughter out, I don't feel like the king is doing what he feels is best for the kingdom. He's doing what he feels is easiest. He's not learning at all. He's just sticking with something that he has no basis to believe in, other than this is how it's been done. That's the only thing that he believes in, is this is how it's been done, so this is the way we should always do it. That's not a great look, in my opinion. And yeah, the stuff with the church, they are not the good guys in the movie. They are trying to control the masses and bring them into thinking for themselves, into having the church think for them. So yeah, like, that's why I think it's awesome that the movie shows in this world the power of prayer. It's a farce. It does not work. What works is heart and magic. That's what works. That's what kills the dragon. Magic. And yeah, as Carl pointed out, if you ran this adventure as it's written in the movie, it would be very anticlimactic for sure. The PCs, you know, whenever an NPC beats the boss monster at the end of the adventure, that's probably not a great adventure, right? Like, so much of the adventure would be awesome, and then you get to the very end where you're going to fight the dragon, and then all of a sudden a super high-power wizard pops out. It's like, I got this, boys. I don't know. I believe there are some older adventures where this happens, and yeah, it's probably not the best. But this movie is kind of the best. So, and all these calls were the best. Anyway, Spencer, that's it for me. I'm out of here. Take it easy. Peace out.
Thank you very much for that, Joe. And let me make it clear, you are the best. Comparing Dragon Slayer to Lady Hawk, yeah, I think they're both high points in the films we've looked at. I know you felt I gave Lady Hawk a bad rap at the time, but yeah, there was a lot I liked about that film. The script I thought was great, the performances, the look of the movie. It simply came down to the pacing, and on that front alone, I think Dragon Slayer takes it for me. Yeah, an interesting point there about the, you know, young virgins. Why does it have to be young virgins that are sacrificed? Is it just tradition? And if so, why is it tradition? Is it just a practicality? The fact that young virgins are essentially going to be the weakest members of a society? They're going to be the easiest to dispose of? Well, I'll leave that thought for you to ponder. Now, one of the reasons I was holding off this episode was because I was hoping to hear from Jules Bergesser of Jules from NZ podcast. As I knew she wanted to watch the film, I struggled to find it. Someone had uploaded it to YouTube. I was able to share a link. She did actually get the time to watch it and posted up her thoughts on Discord while she was watching it. I thought it would be nice if we had at least one female perspective on the film, considering its content. As Jules hasn't been able to send me a message, I asked her if she wouldn't mind if I read out a few of those posts. And yeah, it was very amusing reading. Let me share a little with you. I won't do the accent. In Jules's own words, be prepared for a running stream of consciousness on Dragon's Lair. Spoilers ahead. The eyes of this magic dude crack me up. Somatic casting needs more eyes. Snake hat is my next caster fashion accessory. He's showing up the kids acting. Why do they keep calling this girl Master? Seems progressive. Wait, what? Okay, so this kid's a dick. I really don't like him right now. Who teases an old man as the first thing you do with power? The dragon reveals with the body parts in close-up is the best bit. Ah, right, she's supposed to be a woman, only she is, and they're blind. Are there any other entrances is the first smart thing I've heard so far. And then he ruins it all by walking in unprepared. The lair effects are cool. I have to go now is the worst reaction I've ever seen to your whole life is a sheltered lie. This caster is like they tried to make him another Philippe of Lady Hawk, but he just isn't likable at all. There is no dragon as the world collapses. Talk about blind faith. I mean, if you're looking for proof of hell and demons, I guess a dragon is pretty close. Ooh, pretty swoop scene. I really don't understand why you wouldn't just go and get knocked up to avoid this whole thing. Or why the king didn't marry off his daughter and get her pregnant so he didn't have to lie. Isn't that super common behaviour? This is suicide by dragon, unless of course her dad stops the lottery, which is the only choice here, of course. Why is the soldier crossing his arms with a torch and a sword? That's going to end badly for him. Why is she out with a basket picking up scales? Are they needed right now? Okay, actually a shield is now the smartest thing this movie has done. Ugh, gross. That comes out of nowhere. Like shield and love. This is ridiculous. Oh my God, I hate it. So much of this is so stupid. Why didn't this get stopped? Oh my God, she's bravely sacrificing herself, or just causing more drama and annoying everyone trying to be sensible. Ah, the women in this movie are the worst. This is embarrassing. These little guides are weirdly cute. Very brain-dead puppetry and animation. I'm into it. Again, the lair action is definitely cool. Damn, this dragon is actually really cool. I expected a bit more magic here. How are we outside without being dead? Bring back the strong, feisty, pretend man lady. Oh God, more killing dragons with prayers. Yay, he/she is back. Yay, real magic. Yay, he knows he sucks. Yay, more flying dragon. Oh my God, he's trying to pay attention to the dragon. Would you stop getting in the way, lady? That dead dragon is pretty well done. Oh my God, I suppose they think their prayers did that. I love how they just... That thing you saw happening, it was this that actually happened. King poses with sword. This is Walt Disney. Oh, the horse is cheesy. I enjoyed that in a weird 80s movie way. What a ride. I hated the women in this film. They were stupid and pointless, both in action and death. Well, thank you very much for that, Jules. Not quite the reaction I'd anticipated. We get the gist of what you appreciated and what you didn't there. Well, on that bombshell, I think it's time we wrapped things up. Well, that's quite enough from me. Thank you very much for listening. I really appreciate all the messages I receive. If you'd like to contact me, any questions, feedback or requests, I'd love to hear from you. You can send me an audio message via speakpipe.com/keepofftheborderlands or one word, or you can email me at spencer.freethrall@gmail.com. You can also find me on Discord and a variety of other places as detailed in the show notes. If you enjoy the show, a review or a share would be much appreciated. The music for Keep Off the Borderlands is provided by the multi-talented Mr. TJ Drennan. And it just remains for me to say, take it away, TJ.
Warning, if celebrating the sound of dice hitting the table and pondering the meaning of the many acronyms within your player's handbook doesn't cure that burning sensation, please see your doctor.